after the melee, neither Reverend Hill nor Professor Foster would ever muster the full support of the congregation or get to run Zion Traveler Baptist Church. In time, life somehow returned to some version of normalcy, and Professor Foster instead took comfort in his place as the leading black educator in town. On school mornings, he stood at the front steps of the school with a pocket watch in one hand and a paddle in the other. Sometimes the students came running across the schoolyard late and out of breath. "The train's cut us off, Professor Foster," the children would tell him. "I'm going to cut you off," he'd say, raising his paddle. "Get up early, get up early." He held chapel before class started, quoting the Old Testament in the auditorium for an hour every morning, and he believed in sparing neither the rod, paddle, or switch. He half waited for some child to get out of line so he could make an example out of him, but as anybody who grew up in that world could tell you, he was no better or no worse than any colored schoolmaster in the South when it came to such things. His wife, Audie Alberta Wright Foster, was a prim and ambitious woman who made the society pages of the colored papers as president of the Golden Seal Embroidery Club and for hosting such things as a wedding breakfast for a bridal party in what the Defender called a lovely home prettily decorated for the occasion. Audie was raised in New Orleans, a magic circus of a place compared to Monroe, braided with openly mixed-race Creole people and their patois and jambalaya. She brought the food and ways with her and spent hours on the Rue for her gumbo when things were good. To be reputed to be Creole was enough to make her exotic to some colored people, whether she was actually Creole or not, which no one ever established for sure, but most assumed was true. She was a small woman, with skin the color of chestnuts and wavy black hair. It was said she would have been considered quite a beauty if it weren't for the tight bun she wore low on her head, with the severe center part at her forehead, and the fact that she seemed rarely to smile at anyone other than her children. All of the children were bright, but in the family hierarchy, there was not much Pershing could do to distinguish himself, with one big brother off in medical school and another a star athlete. He played softball with the neighborhood kids, where they used broomsticks for bats, and made their own rules because nobody had seen an official baseball game. But he wasn't especially good at it. Pershing looked for a way to prove himself. There were 3 fig trees in their yard, and he picked the figs and sold them to the neighbors, 35 cents for a gallon bucket. He gave them a broad smile and charmed them into believing they needed the figs for breakfast or for preserves or to can for the coming winter. He practiced smiling in the mirror and writing with his left hand, even though he didn't need to. He lived for the pat on the head from his father, but especially his mother for washing out the wash tub or any little thing that he did. He took to cleaning the house to make them happy and to keep the compliments coming, but it only felt good as long as he did it before they could ask. He was crushed whenever he fell short. His parents punished him by making him go to the back steps and sit there. He sat hugging his dog and cried. Sometimes his mother got tired of him sitting on the steps and called him in. Otherwise, he couldn't leave until his father said so. "All right," Professor Foster would say. "Come back in." It was true he couldn't milk a cow, but he didn't mind churning. He churned the milk as it soured and clabbered. Audie skimmed the butter off, and he proceeded to go door to door, selling the butter and the buttermilk in a lard bucket with a cultivated earnestness and the crisp airs he was beginning to master. "Mrs. Poe, don't you want to buy some milk from me? Can I start bringing you milk on Thursdays?" He found that he could get people to like him, and that if people liked him, he could get what he wanted. For each grade, there was one teacher, and when Pershing got to the 7th grade, Mama taught him. She stood at the front of the room and drilled math and verse into him and the rest of the class without humor or partiality. Sometimes Pershing got restless and leaned over to talk to Moses Potter or Nimrod Sherman or maybe Jimmy Peters. When he did, Audie stopped in the middle of the lesson and glared down hard at him. "Pershing, be quiet." She stood by the blackboard and waited. "Pershing, be quiet." He didn't hear her, engrossed as he was. She marched over to his desk. He felt her shadow looming over him and continued to talk. She raised her left hand and smacked him in front of the class. The other children laughed and laughed. Pershing put his head down and knew not to test Mama anymore. He could get away with less with his mother than with any other teacher in the school. It seemed to him that for every good thing about being the teacher and principal's son, there was a bad thing to it. If he was caught running down the street, somebody would stick her head out the window and remind him who he was. "Boy, get on out the street. I'ma tell Miss Foster on you." To further complicate his life, the Fosters were bookish, small-boned people, and the children of the sawmill hands towered over Pershing. The days when he didn't walk home with Mama, when he was alone on the streets of Newtown, some of the boys lay in wait for him. They surrounded him and taunted him for the way he carried himself and the half-inch of extra privilege he had over them. "You think you somebody 'cause you fess a Foster's boy. You think you better than anybody else 'cause you a Foster." They made a circle around him and felt bigger because of it. If Professor Foster had whipped the boys with his strap that day, Pershing paid for it that afternoon. They beat him and had a good time doing it. He took it because he had to, and fighting wasn't in him. Telling his father would have made things worse. Professor Foster knew no other way to keep errant children in line and would have beat the boys again if he knew what they'd done to his youngest boy, which would have only made life harder for Pershing. So he kept it to himself. As Pershing got to be a teenager, he started venturing out into the neighborhood, poking his head into the juke joints and the pool hall where the hip cats drank late into the night. It was where the men slapped Woo on the back as they poured him another shot of whiskey. But whenever Pershing poked his head inside, he got the same wave of the hand from the proprietor and the men lining the wall. "Boy, get out of here. You ain't got no business in here. Professor Foster wouldn't want you in here." Woo wouldn't have minded and never told him not to come in. But the word had spread somehow that Professor Foster and his wife had a different life in mind for Pershing. There were pressures coming at him from every direction. His high-minded parents, trying to make up in a single generation all that they had been denied through generations of slavery, bullying kids who taunted him and resented his station, tentative though it was. Neighborhood people watching his every move. Then there were the reminders that no matter what he did or how smart he might be, he would always be seen as inferior to the lowliest person in the ruling caste, which only meant he had to work even harder to prove the system wrong, because it had been drilled into him that he had to be better than the system construed him to be. He lived under the accumulated weight of all these expectations. "People in the town demanded more of us," he said years later, "and we had to give it. I respected what they told me, and anything I didn't want them to see, I kept it out of their sight." Every few years, a teacher from Monroe Colored High loaded a band of students onto the flatbed of a pickup truck and rattled across the Missouri Pacific Railway tracks. They passed the rich people's porticos and pulled up to the back entrance of the white high school in town. The boys jumped out and began stacking the truck bed with the books the white school was throwing away. That is how Monroe Colored High School got its books. The boys loaded the truck with old geography and English texts, some without covers and with pages torn out and love notes scrawled in the margins, and headed back to their side of town. By the time he was old enough to understand where the books came from, Pershing was fast putting together the pieces of the world he lived in. He knew there was a dividing line, but it was hitting him in the face now. He was showing a talent for science and was getting to the point that he needed reference books to do his lesson. But it was against the law for colored people to go to the public library. And the library at the colored high school did not live up to its name, he said years later. He was in the eighth grade when word filtered to his side of the tracks that Monroe was getting a new high school. It wouldn't replace the old building that Monroe Colored High was in. It was for the white students, who already had a big school. It would be called Neville High. The colored people could see it going up when they ventured to the other side of the tracks. It rose up like a castle, four stories of brick and concrete, with separate wings and a central tower, looking as if it belonged at Princeton or Yale. It opened in 1931 on 22 acres of land. The city fathers made a fuss over the state-of-the-art laboratories for physics and chemistry, the 2,200-seat balconied auditorium, the expanded library, and the fact that it was costing $664,000 to build. As the new high school took shape across town, Pershing watched his father rise in the black of morning to milk the cows and walk the mile and a half to open his building, the size of a grade school. His father, his mother, and the other teachers at Monroe Colored High School were working long hours with hand-me-down supplies for a fraction of the pay their white counterparts were getting. In Louisiana in the 1930s, white teachers and principals were making an average salary of $1,165 a year. Colored teachers and principals were making $499 a year, 43% of what the white ones were. Pershing's parents could console themselves that they were faring better than colored teachers in other southern states, a reflection not necessarily of their superior performance, but that there were states even worse than Louisiana when it came to teachers' pay. In neighboring Mississippi, white teachers and principals were making $630 a year, while the colored ones were paid a third of that, $215 a year, hardly more than field hands. But knowing that didn't ease the burden of the Fosters' lives, get their children through college, or allow them to build assets to match their status and education. The disparity in pay, reported without apology in the local papers for all to see, would have far-reaching effects. It would mean that even the most promising of colored people, having received next to nothing in material assets from their slave foreparents, had to labor with the knowledge that they were now being underpaid by more than half, that they were so behind it would be all but impossible to accumulate the assets their white counterparts could, and that they would, by definition, have less to leave succeeding generations than similar white families. Multiplied over the generations, it would mean a wealth deficit between the races that would require a miracle windfall or near asceticism on the part of colored families if they were to have any chance of catching up or amassing anything of value. Otherwise, the chasm would continue, as it did for blacks as a group, even into the succeeding century. The layers of accumulated assets built up by the better-paid dominant caste, generation after generation, would factor into a wealth disparity of white Americans having an average net worth 10 times that of black Americans by the turn of the 21st century, dampening the economic prospects of the children and grandchildren of both Jim Crow and the Great Migration, before they were even born. For now, each day, Pershing's parents and the families whose children they taught had to live with the reality that they had to do more with less. Southern states made no pretense as to the lopsided division of resources to white and colored schools, devoting as much as $10 per white student for every dollar spent on a colored student, and showing little interest beyond that meager investment. The money allocated to the colored children is spent on the education of the white children, a local school superintendent in Louisiana said bluntly. We have twice as many colored children of school age as we have white, and we use their money. Colored children are mighty profitable to us. When a fire broke out in the basement of Monroe Colored High School, destroying classroom furniture and equipment, the city refused to so much as replace the desks and teaching supplies that had burned to ashes, as the Monroe News Star reported. The tax dollars were earmarked for Neville. The colored parents, already strapped, would have to raise the money themselves. That would be just one more thing weighing on Professor Foster. As it was, he wasn't making half of what the Neville High School principal made. Nobody in Newtown would be allowed in the new building when it opened, other than to clean it, and the idea of Pershing attending it, no matter how smart he was unthinkable. It was not something the Fosters would have wanted to dwell on, as it would have done them no good. But their very existence, their personal aspirations, and the purpose of their days were in direct opposition to the white ruling class policy on colored education. That is, that colored people needed no education to fulfill their God-given role in the South. If these Negroes become doctors and merchants, or buy their own farms, a Southern woman told the celebrated journalist Ray Stannard Baker, what shall we do for servants? The unfairness started to eat at Pershing. It was a curse to be able to see it, better not to know. But the older he got, the more he was starting to want, and the more he wanted, the harder it was to accept that he might never get it, all because of a chemical in his skin that some people resented and felt superior to, and that no one on this earth could change. To make matters worse, he had the misfortune of having developed exquisite taste, and what little he was exposed to only fed his ambitions. Everything you wanted was white, and the best, he said. Pershing had started to notice the girls, and they started to notice him. They were getting to an age where they would walk home from school together, meet at the Paramount for the picture show, and eventually end up in a park or a field somewhere. Somebody would get a car from an uncle or someone or other, and they would drive up to where the new Neville High was, shiny new and perched high on a hill. It was lush and secluded, and when they had finished with the girls, they whirred past the grounds and flung their spent condoms on the green. That's how we showed our resentment, he said years later. Don't think we were blind. Just before dark, when the sky is neither blue nor black but purple, Pershing stepped out of the tin tub to get ready for a Saturday night. He put on long pants and cheap cologne and walked in the direction of the Miller and Roy building on the colored side of Five Points, about a mile from the center of town. It was in the shadow of downtown, in a world of its own. The axis was 18th and Desert. Across from the office building was the drugstore. Behind the drugstore was a cafe. Behind the cafe was a liquor store. Across from the liquor store was the pool hall. He had his shirt buttoned low and open as he strutted down Desert. He was two blocks from the Miller and Roy building when a car pulled up to the curb. The exhaust spit and coughed. A white man leaned out of the window. Hey, boy. Pershing kept walking. He hated being called boy, even though he was one. They barked it at the sawmill hands, and it bent over old colored men, and even upstanding men like his father. He was 14, and it was already beginning to grate on him. Hey, boy! Pershing stopped and consoled himself. You can answer him because you are a boy. You're not 21 yet. Technically, you're still a boy. That makes it okay for him to address you as boy. He turned toward the car and kept it to, yes, instead of, yes, sir. Boy, I'll pay you if you get me a nice, clean colored girl. Pershing breathed deep. Ever since his sister Gold had hit puberty, he could hardly walk down the street with her without white men with snuff in their mouth yelling out what they would do to her. It made him want to vomit. She kept her head up and held his hand tight and walked through it. He could never defend her, never stand up to a gang of them on a street corner. That was death, he would say years later. Pershing knew it from the sheer insanity all around him when he was 11 years old. A white mob burned down the courthouse across the border in Sherman, Texas. It started with a colored man accused of raping a white woman, a confession extracted, a trial hastily set. But just as the trial opened, a mob stormed the courtroom and torched the building to get to the defendant, George Hughes. Court officials fled through a second-story window and left Hughes in a steel vault with a bucket of water. Firefighters tried to save the courthouse, but the mob slashed the water hoses to keep the blaze going. The mob then dynamited the vault where Hughes had been left. The mob found him dead, crushed by the explosion, the water bucket almost empty. The courthouse then burned to the ground. Disappointed that they had not gotten to Hughes before he died, the people in the mob hanged his body from a cottonwood tree and set it on fire with furniture they looted from a nearby colored hotel. Then they torched the colored district as the colored people of Sherman fled to the homes of white friends or left town. A half dozen colored homes escaped the torching only because a white man told the mob the houses belonged to him. This was the world Pershing was growing up in. He had learned the rules early in life. Now he was standing at a vacant curb, just him and a white man out prowling. He had never seen the man before, imagined he must have come in from the country and made a beeline for the colored section with one thing in mind, as was his prerogative. Not just any colored girl. A nice, clean colored girl. The man waited, and Pershing assessed the situation. He was on the colored side of town, a block from the rooming house. He knew every turn and alley. He was in the majority around here. He looked at the man. A nice, clean, colored girl, he said, calculating the risks of what he might say next. Let me see. I tell you what, you get your mama for me, and I'll get you one. He didn't wait for the man's reaction. Pershing vanished into the colored alleys of Five Points. He couldn't believe what had come out of his mouth. His face was flushed and his hand shook. He could get hanged for that. Nothing more needed to happen to remind him who had the power over him and what they could do if they wanted. You lived with it, Pershing said years later, but it wasn't that you liked the taste of it.